And now, it is my distinct pleasure to introduce tonight's very special guest speaker. Jennifer Ouellette is a science writer, a very successful science writer. She has three wonderful and popular books. She writes on the intersection between science and popular culture. She's a prolific blogger, blogs for Discover News and Scientific American. She has recently been on the Craig Ferguson Show, the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson, a wonderful YouTube clip showing her talking about her book, and it's this book that she's going to share more about with us tonight. This is The Calculus Diaries, How Math Can Help You Lose Weight, Win at Vegas, and Survive a Zombie Apocalypse. Please welcome Jennifer Ouellette.
Oh, I'm so impressed to see this many people here. I will just start out by saying that my high school math teacher is having a very, very good laugh these days because I was that obnoxious kid in his class who was going, this is boring. Do I really have to know this? What good am I? When am I ever going to use this in real life? And he kept trying to tell me and the rest of the students in the class that math was important, blah, 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 blah. But we get this idea that there are two kinds of people, the non-math people and the math people, and you can only be one or the other, and if you're a non-math person and you, like me, go on to earn a degree in English literature, you know, your motto is, this is an actual t-shirt that I had in college, I'm an English major, you do the math. But of course, that's a very, very limited viewpoint, and I actually am very grateful for the fact that as an adult, after I got out of college, after I'd started a career, or was trying to start a career as a writer, I ended up writing about physics. And as part of that, I ended up having to really come to terms with the fact that I hated math. And I had to really come to terms with the fact that I was not as bad at it as I thought I was. And that was a really tremendous thing. When I started talking to physicists and interviewing them and talking to mathematicians, I realized that their knowledge of math meant that they could see things in the world that I couldn't see. This little cartoon here, I think, really captures it. There's how we see the world. We can look at a pretty sunset, as I did with my, you know, my then fiancé before we got married. We were driving along a nice little beach. We stopped to look at a sunset. And I was admiring the beautiful sunset, and he looked out at the sunset and thought and said, wouldn't it be great to take a Fourier transform of those waves? Now, a Fourier transform is essentially a mathematical function. It's a calculus thing where you take a wavelength or a compound wavelength of light, you break it down into its component frequencies. It's used everywhere in digital processing. You know, every time you like listen to music or whatever, you're actually somewhere a Fourier transform is being done. But he looked out at that scene and he saw things that I did not, and that made me realize that maybe it was time to once and for all face down the calculus monster. And when I did, I was expecting this big scary thing, because we've seen those textbooks, they're like this. Calculus is about change and motion. That's it. It's the tool that we use to describe things in the physical world that are changing and moving. So, let me tell you why it's important to know that underlying layer, because, you know, you could say, well, don't harsh my mellow, man. I'm enjoying the sunset. I don't want to hear about the math. I don't care about the frequencies that make up those pretty wavelengths. Math, if you know the math, it can help you see things that might be counterintuitive. And the best example of this is something that I think that most of us learn in high school, which is that objects fall at the same rate regardless of math. Regardless of mass. Now, we all memorize this, we all accept it because we're taught it by our teachers, but when I started, you know, writing about physics and hanging out with physicists, I said, you know, I've always wondered about this. I asked a physicist friend of mine, I believe that this is true because I've seen demonstrations and things in a vacuum. I says, but how did they figure out that was true? I mean, we didn't actually even know how to create a vacuum when this equation was first developed. And he said, I'm glad you asked that. He goes, it's going to require a little bit of math. And I went, oh, no. No, that's okay. I don't need to know that bad. And I said, no, it's okay. It's not real math. It's just algebra. Because that's that's how physicists think. And he walked me through the equation. And he was right. It, A, was not nearly as scary, and once he explained what all the symbols meant, he said, look, here's the big M, that's the mass of the Earth, and then we have these little M's for the masses of the two objects, and he walked me through the derivation, and the little M's canceled out, and you end up with that. You know, the mass of the object is irrelevant to the calculation. So people like Galileo saw that, did that calculation, and said it shouldn't matter. And all that, what we see with our eyes is actually not what the reality is. And they were right. So that's why you should care about that. The other thing is, I always approach these things through history. I certainly learned about physics that way, and I decided that was a good way to learn about math. And there's a reason for that. Because science builds on everything that came before. If you want to understand a piece of modern-day science, there's 200, 1,000 years of history that went into coming up with that piece of science. So I figured that a good place to start, calculus. And that took me not just 500 years back, but all the way back to Archimedes. He was one of the predominant thinkers in Syracuse. He was an ingenious engineer. The ruler of Syracuse actually had him in charge of the defenses against the invading Roman army. But he was fascinated by the problem of curves. This was at a time when they were pretty good with geometry. The ancient Greeks kind of knew their geometry. If you had something regular, like a perfect triangle or a circle even, or a nice square or a rectangle, they could figure out the area. We all learned these in junior high or high school. This is easy, easy stuff. But what happens if you have something that's a parabola? It's not a perfect circle or a perfect rectangle or a triangle. What if it's this big, messy wave thing? How do you figure out the area under that curve? And they came up with a method using, say, a triangle, where he would basically draw a big triangle. You can kind of see the outlines of it there. And he would figure out the area of that triangle, and he'd put that off to one side. And then he'd draw a couple of smaller triangles in the remaining space, figure out that area, put it off onto the side, and he'd add all those up, many, many triangles, always smaller and smaller each time. And essentially the idea was that the more little triangles you got, the smaller the triangles got, the better your approximation would be to the area under the curve. And they called this the method of exhaustion for good reason. But he was this close to inventing integral calculus and he didn't know it. Now, we care about parabolas because, among other things, I think you will see, it's gonna come up a lot in the course of this talk, which is why I'm bringing it up now. This is, again, this notion of things being hidden under the surface, these underlying connections, things that seem completely different are actually described by the same mathematics, and the parabola shows up over and over and over again. You're going to become very familiar with this. And one of the things that Archimedes came up with this idea of a death ray. He basically had this curved mirror in the shape of a parabola, the idea that it would capture sunlight, redirect it, the heat and light, and he could use it to burn the invading ships in the harbor. The Mythbusters famously tried to recreate this experiment, and they did, on their second attempt, manage, with great, you know, effort, to at least get a small fire burning on one of the ships. They concluded that probably it was very inefficient, even if it was possible, and you'd be better off shooting flaming arrows. There is a real-world equivalent. This is the Vidara Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. Someone did not do their math when they were designing this hotel. It is a sheer glass reflective surface. It's curved, it's in this nice parabolic curve shape to it. And it turns out, it gets really hot in Vegas in the summer, 112 degrees. The sun hits this one sweet spot, directs right down to the pool area. It became front page news in Vegas because this lawyer from out of town was sitting in the deck chair. And suddenly he just started getting really warm. And then he realized that the hair on the back of his neck was burning. And he got up and he panicked and he went to like tell the bartender, he goes, oh yeah, we call that the death spot. It actually melted the plastic on the newspaper there. So, you know, math can hurt you. I mentioned that Archimedes was this close to inventing integral calculus, and he might have done it, except that even his ingenuity could not keep off the invading Romans for long. They sacked Syracuse, and whoops, they killed him. The greatest mathematical mind in Western civilization essentially was trying to finish drawing a little drawing in the sand, and the soldier got impatient with him and just cleft his head in two. So we did not get integral calculus. Calculus would end up not being invented for another 1,600 years. It was funny, a friend of mine said that unfortunately, the Romans' great contribution to mathematics was killing the greatest mathematical mind. So, and you actually did see it in the intellectual development. The focus of math and science at that point switched over to the Arab world. And we did, in fact, around 1100 or so, have the invention of algebra. Those of you who have taken algebra and hated as much as I did because I was just bored silly, we learned to hate this guy. But when I started really reading about him, I realized that algebra initially did not have all those scary symbols. It was essentially sentences, it was words, it was a logical argument that he was constructing, and he was using this means as a way of doing it, but he did it with words. And eventually people figured out that, you didn't have to say the artist formerly known as Prince, you could use a little funny symbol, and everybody would know what that meant. And it would just make it much easier to manipulate the symbols, and you could end up figuring out logical inconsistencies that much better. You could get both sides to balance. It ended up just being a much more efficient means of doing that. So now we have algebra, and we have geometry. We really want to bring those two together. And that is when we get to Fermat and Descartes. They are the two that, independently of each other, kind of around the same time, figured out that geometry and algebra were essentially two different ways of looking at the same thing. Algebra is the more abstract, symbolic way of looking at it. And if you want to see what a mathematical function looks like, you plot it out onto this Cartesian graph. It merges the two. And when you merge the two, it ends up being kind of a powerful thing. It's often said that there are two kinds of mathematical minds. There's the abstract algebraic thinker and the geometrical thinker, the one who thinks more in pictures. That's still true. It's very rare to find a professional mathematician who can do both. I remember watching a couple of physics talks, and it was very clear that one of the professors, a physicist, was very much a visual geometric thinker, and the other one, the woman, was definitely an algebraic person. When she was talking about a black hole, she was writing the equation, and he was drawing pictures. And either way is perfectly valid way of thinking of the same thing, but by bringing those two together, you pave the way for calculus. Because a geometric curve is static, but the world is not a static place. So when we start thinking about the physics of the world, when we start thinking about the world as it actually is, we want to be able to describe the world as it changes, as it moves. And that is where calculus came in, and that was Isaac Newton's greatest genius. He's the one who realized, hey, a parabolic curve, which seems sort of still and static in geometry, is actually a thing of beauty. It actually describes movement, an apple falling from the tree, for example, or planets in elliptical orbits. While I was writing the calculus diaries, obviously I had to go back and learn, some very rudimentary calculus and also review algebra and trigonometry because it had been a very long time. We would often find ourselves in the living room in the evening, and I was doing my little baby calculus, and he'd be working on his big fancy physics papers. And there was one point where I asked him a question. He goes, "Oh, it's funny. I actually just used that in my calculation." And I went, "But this is baby calculus. And you're like a big, smart professional physicist." And he went, "Same tool. It's part of a bigger calculation, but that little piece, that little tool, is something that is used over and over again." So it was a lesson to me not to put down what I was doing, that in fact professional physicists still use even these fundamental things. They use it in the service of much greater things, but there's a reason we learn these very basic lessons. So, you can think of these geometric curves as the faces of functions, and the way I organized the book was to look at, say, the top 7 or 8 functions in calculus and their curves, their faces, which is why I called this talk Dangerous Curves. But that wasn't enough. I mean, I was determined when I was writing this book not to do what I did in high school. I was determined not to just memorize the rules, because it turns out many of us are very good at this, right? We figure out what we have to do to get the A. And we're very good at blindly following the rules, and we don't really understand why it is what we're doing, where these things are coming from. We don't really grasp the importance of it, and I did not want that to happen. So one of the first questions I asked is, okay, I get it. I get that these are functions. I've read all the little definitions, but to be perfectly honest, I want to know, where did you get that? I want to know where this function came from. And it seems very basic, but it was a very good exercise for me to do. My husband would basically give me the function, the algebraic version, and he would have me plug in numbers all along the graph, and he would have me solve that, plot the point. It was the method of exhaustion all over again, believe me. And eventually you could see a curve forming. You could see that the different points, the data points, would form this curve. And that is essentially what a curve is. You take every possible point on that curve, you know, and you fill in the value, and then you get this lovely thing. The key here is that it's bigger than the sum of its parts. Once you know that mathematical function, you know that curve, then it becomes a predictive model. Once you know one function, then you can use that to figure out other things that you want to know about the system that you're trying to model. And in this case, I dragged my husband to Disneyland, and I made him go on all the rides. And we went looking for physics and calculus on the rides. And one of the things, one of my favorites was the Tower of Terror. I don't know if you, how many of you are familiar with the Tower of Terror or something similar? Some of you. Essentially, it's they put you in this little box, and they whip you up very quickly to, you know, upwards, and you get this moment of hang time at the top, and then they drop you. And then they do it a couple more times. You go up and down, and you get that little wonderful moment of zero gravity hang time there, and then you end up at the end of the bottom. So we went on this ride, and I'm all woohoo, and my husband at the end is very excited, and I'm thinking he enjoyed the ride. He goes, "We just made a parabola. This is awesome." This is what it's like to be married to a physicist. But you know, here's the thing. Let's say that, you know, we know, because we know it's a parabola, free fall, we know our position at every point in time. We know that because we know the function. We know that that forms a parabolic curve. It's great. What if we want to know how fast we're going? That we don't know. We didn't bother to measure it. We didn't think to measure it. We didn't think to bring in a speedometer or something to figure out how fast we're going. We can actually use calculus to figure this out. And we can take the position function, and we can take a derivative, and that will give us the velocity function, which tells us how fast we were going at every point in time. You can take one function, turn it into another, and then you can use that to solve the problem that you're trying to solve. So it becomes this kind of interlocking, interrelated sort of thing. You are solving problems. It can get very complicated. We also went on Space Mountain, which he loved also. In this case, and this actually is done all the time. If you've ever physics classes often go to amusement parks, they build their own accelerometers. These are devices that measure acceleration, the G-forces. And you can use that to measure all the G-forces and map it out along your ride. All of that taken together is going to be your acceleration function. But here's the thing, on Space Mountain, you're in the dark. It's not the most exciting coaster ride, but you don't know where you're going. What if you want to know? What if you want to track the path that you took? Well, you don't know that, but you had your little accelerometer and you know your acceleration. You know all of those g-forces. You can actually take a double integral. You have to go through two steps now. You have to take one integral and that's going to give you the velocity, and then you take another one of the velocity and that gives you the position. It's the adding up of little things over time. But that's another way of solving a very real practical problem. And, you know, Space Mountain. So there's a lot of examples. If you really want to get complicated, you can do the Mad Teacup ride, because now we're talking about circular motion and angular momentum and vectors, which is the direction in which you are moving, and they can change a lot. It's quite elaborate, actually. You have these little individual teacups that you get to spin, you know, one way, but they're on a platform that is spinning this way, and that platform in turn is on another platform that is spinning this way. And what you find as you're going along on the ride is that there are times when no matter how hard you pull, you can't get yourself to spin very quickly. And every now and then you hit that sweet spot and you can spin really, really fast. That's the vectors. Sometimes they all line up perfectly and you get to spin really, really fast. And sometimes they're all canceling each other out and working against each other and you can't get past that. Again, a very complicated thing to actually do in the classroom, but a wonderful example of both math and physics in the real world. Now, around the same time I was writing this book, we were also house hunting. It had never even occurred to me that I was doing calculus in my house hunting, but it is a form of comparison shopping. And here what you're trying to find is you're trying to have an optimization problem. You're trying to find the best way to do something, or the one thing that most meets your criteria. In this case, I think we kept it to a couple variables for simplicity in the book, but you can have as many as you want, and it just gets more complicated. Think about what you're doing when you're buying a house or buying a new car or a cool dress for the prom. I mean, you have certain constraints and variables, right? There's price, there's location, there is, you know, you definitely want that little sunroof or whatever. And you figure out which things are most important to you, and you rate them, and you look at various things and figure out how they measure up according to those variables. and add all that together, and at some point you've picked those things that fall along the top of that curve. That's your optimization curve. So I was doing this the old-fashioned way with columns and things like that, and my husband said, you know, you could just make a function and it will tell you. And we ended up doing this as kind of an exercise, and he was right. The things that I was already leaning towards based on my little columnated thing actually did turn out to be the same houses that showed up, you know, in our model. So, you know, experiment theory, it all comes together. I went surfing. Wave dynamics, any kind of wave, that Fourier transform I talked about, that's a sine wave. Radio waves, anything to do with that, any kind of sound, any kind of light, you are going to be dealing with calculus. More practically, in order to surf, because I took my first surfing lesson when I went to Hawaii, you have to match the speed of the wave as it comes in, and you've got to calculate how fast it's going, when it's going to get to you, and then you yourself have to be moving. It's actually a miracle anyone can surf at all, but eventually we figure it out. Architecture. I had written a piece for New Scientist, which is, I think, one of the reasons I started getting interested in math, too, on arches in architecture. It turns out, how did they know how to build those arches in like the 1500s or 1600s? And it turns out that Robert Hooke, among others, had figured out, he had this line called, as hangs the flexible chain, so rigid is the inverted arch. So if you want to know how the forces are going to line up perfectly to have a stable arch once it's inverted, you hang it, you take a chain and you hang it and you see where it naturally falls. Where are the lines of forces nestling? And that forms the catenary curve. That is actually a calculus problem. Then you invert that, and you've got your ideal shape for an arch. If you've ever seen the Sydney Opera House, it has a very, very elaborate structure with all those curves and things, and they definitely needed math, and specifically calculus, to be able to figure out how all the forces were going to work in order to make that building stable. Calculus in the real world again. Cooling cup of coffee, and we got drenched at Space Mountain, and so we ended up doing a little mini calculus problem while we were waiting for our clothes to dry off. It turns out that slow drip, drip, drip does follow an exponential decay curve. Exercise. You don't think about this because the machines now do it for us, but when you're in the gym and you're trying to burn off calories on the Stairmaster, whatever, you know, and you want to know how many calories you've burned, your exercise machine is essentially taking, it's essentially integrating the rate of the calories burned to get the total calories expended. And it will probably, in order to get that rate, it's going to need to know things like your height, your weight, you know, your age. The more of those variables you can figure in, the more accurate the reading will be. Often those machines are really far off, just in case you think you really did burn off 1,000 calories. But it is exactly, nonetheless, conceptually what's being done here is calculus. And I know you're all curious about the zombies. I didn't just make that up. It turns out that, you know, not only is there a calculus of zombies, but there's an actual mathematical paper based on the calculus of zombies. It was done by a man who's actually, I think he's Toronto, I believe. His name's Robert Smith. He did this with some of his students. He wanted to construct an epidemiological model, which is essentially how you study the spread of diseases and also how you assess how effective your intervention strategies are likely to be. So this is actually a very complicated problem. Among other things, you know, you have to do several different equations. You basically have these coupled differential equations in order to do this. In this case, you've got like three or four that he had to like work through. Because you have to figure out, you know, how many humans are born during the given part of time, how many become zombies during that time period, how many die, you know, how many of the dead become zombies, how many zombies you actually end up killing, you know, it becomes a very complicated thing. But nonetheless, it turned out to be a viable model, and they ended up with an answer. It turns out that hiding in the shopping mall, you know, we've seen the movies, we know that doesn't work. You know, it's like, they're going to come and find you regardless. It also turns out that if you do absolutely nothing when the first zombie appears, and you just kind of, you don't kill it right away, it will wipe out an entire village, the entire population, in basically 3 days. Because the dead don't stay dead. This just ruins everything. You get this exponential growth curve, and they just overrun. Before you know it, the whole world is zombies. I don't think he actually figured out what happens when there's no food left for the zombies, whether they all start dying off, but history would tell us that that would be the case. So the only viable strategy is what he called the impulsive eradication scheme. Zombieland put it best, time to nut up or shut up. You want to basically kill as many zombies as fast as possible in a shorter period as possible, because that's the only way you're going to stop the spread. The rate of the spread of the disease is so great, that's the only way you have any shot. And even then, Zombieland, I wouldn't necessarily call it a happy ending. It's like, there were a few survivors. There's a caveat with these kinds of models, and I do feel compelled to say this, which is particularly when you're modeling human behavior. When disease outbreaks, that is kind of one of the unknown variables. You know, how are human beings really going to behave? We know how we think they ought to behave. We can tell them, based on the math, how they should behave. Will they behave that way? And how can you possibly study that ethically? Because you certainly can't, you know, wire up a town of villagers, give them all the plague, and then see how they react, because that would just be horrible. But you can do it in World of Warcraft. And the wonderful thing, several years ago, they actually did have an epidemic similar to, it was called Corrupted Blood. And essentially, it was a virus that was designed to be a challenge for one of the upper levels, but somebody kind of screwed up when they were doing the coding. Only experienced players were supposed to get hit with this virus, and then it basically meant that it would slowly sap away their life points, and they had a certain amount of time in order to finish, you know, whatever, you know, kill the captain on that level. That was the task that they had to in order to win that level. So, but the problem is, they didn't stop to think. There were also these non-playable animal companions and things that could just move freely about the space, and they got infected. And nobody thought about those animal companions, much the way that during the Black Death, nobody thought that rats and fleas had anything to do with, you know, how this thing was spreading. So it ended up spreading to, like, all the levels. And here's the thing, if you're a beginning player, you don't have that many life points. You die like that. And you die horribly, like your head explodes. You can actually see these little bloody things there. You can go online, there's all these YouTube videos that people recorded of the gameplay, of just people freaking out. And this one woman at Rutgers decided, this is fantastic, this is the experiment I've been looking for. She actually collaborated with the game designer, and they gave her access to their data files of what happened when this incident broke out. They had to actually, it wiped out three servers. They had to reboot the entire system. And she found that the player behavior was very, very true to life. You had people who freaked out. They were told to stay. They were told to honor quarantine and not spread it, but they freaked out and they ran anyway. You had guys, that people who did that deliberately, thinking, well, if I'm dying, I'm taking everyone with me. This is how people think, okay? You had one guy who decided it was his job to be the prophet of doom, and he spent the rest of his brief avatar life in this town square proclaiming the end of days. And, you know, you had people who rushed in to help. You had people who were, like, not even in that level, but heard something really exciting was going on. They were like the reporters who rushed into the war zone, say, let me see what's going on. Oh no, I'm dead. So you have to take these things into account when you do mathematical models, is my point. So where am I now when it comes to calculus? You know, it's funny, I think people, because I wrote this book about calculus, like occasionally I get people thinking, well, so now you're like this whiz, right? And you're going to like ace the AP, you know, SAT exam. No. When I say I was doing baby calculus, I mean I was doing baby calculus. And I would say that my level is still very much at the C. Jane run, maybe moving to the next level of calculus. It certainly is not the level that they do at the Perimeter Institute, nowhere near. That's not the point. When people ask me what I gained out of this exercise, it wasn't, you know, I taught myself calculus, yay. I gained an appreciation for why math was important. It gave me insights into the stories that I continue to write. It made me a better science writer. It helped me see connections in the world. It helped me understand why my husband thinks weird things the way he does. So the real value that came out of that was this idea that I didn't have to ace the AP exam. I think that particularly when we're young, we get caught up in the idea of having to, like, you know, always get the 100%. And it really should be about the joy of learning new things. And I am still learning. I'm still learning more about math. Every time I go back and do a calculus problem, I see something new in it. Every time I write a physics story about something that I thought I understood perfectly and I start looking into the math now because I'm no longer afraid of it, I gain a little bit of extra insight. It's all part of this wonderful learning process. And that is, I think, something that I didn't have when I was growing up. And it raises, I think, the other important part about math phobia that I want to talk about. Because I'm not really here tonight to teach you calculus. I want to give you an idea of why it's important, what it's about, what it's good for. But ultimately, it all comes down to, why do I need to know this stuff? And I guess that would be, you know, my message to the students out there in particular. Whenever I talk to young people and they ask me that question, I get where they're coming from, because I was that student. I was the person standing there saying, when am I ever going to use this? I'm never going to use this. And maybe I don't use it every day, but I didn't know that at the time. And it ended up turning out that it would have been extremely useful for me. Who knew I was going to become a writer about physics? I didn't. I didn't even know science writing existed. The same goes for you. So my plea to the young people, you know, is not to cut off your choices that early. You know, learn the math, do the math, make us do the math, because that is what gives us choice. And then later on, if you don't want to learn anymore, that's great. But at least you'll be making a choice, and you won't be having that choice being made for you. And this is where I go do the shameless self-promotion. I do have a book. It's called The Calculus Diaries. A lot of the stuff that you saw earlier on is detailed in the chapters. At this point, I want to just open it up for questions, because I think the most interesting thing about talking to these audiences is having a dialogue.
My question is, in calculus, do you see the world as cause and effect, and for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction? Do you see it in that way?
Are you asking if I see it in a more reductive way?
Yes.
You know, yes, I think I probably do. It gets complicated because, you know, obviously it's not as simple as Newtonian. There's a lot more math than just Newtonian, you know, equal and opposite reaction. And particularly, I think when you're talking about biological systems, the mathematics gets incredibly complicated. You've got so many variables. There's such a thing as called nonlinear systems, which are almost very, very difficult to model because there's so many variables and they're all interdependent and they're all interacting. So at that point, the math gets very, very complicated. But I think fundamentally, we are still talking, you know, about something that is governed by these things that are happening below the surface. We have this notion of emergence, that, you know, the sum is greater than the parts, that you can have, and you see this, say, in ants. You know, a single ant might not be able to make a difference, but when they get all of them collectively, this other thing, this other property emerges, and they end up acting as one. You can pour them like a fluid. They actually start acting a little bit like a solid or a fluid. Those sorts of things, you know, are a little bit more how I like to think about math, because I like my math messy. My husband's a physicist. He likes his math clean and neat. He wants to know the underlying problem. There's room for both, and they are not mutually exclusive. They're just two different ways of describing systems.
Okay, thank you. And another question, Barbara?
Is it possible to tell in our solar system, the way it is now, where we have the center of gravity, at which point will all these planets be aligned in one straight line, and would that change our center of gravity to cause any tidal waves?
Well, I'm not a cosmologist, but no. my husband is. I think that you're thinking of that rare planetary alignment. I can't pronounce it. It's called syzygy or something like that. There was an X-Files episode about that. No, it does not. I mean, we have this idea that it should, but in fact, you know, it's a much more complicated system than that. Again, this is where the complicated dynamics, you know, and the math comes in. It's not just one or two planets. It's not just those seven planets. There's all kinds of things that are happening. They're all moving. It really does not. People have actually looked into that, and I can tell you with great confidence that that is not going to happen.
I have a question. I was recently in a debate. You mentioned that mathematics, kids should take mathematics. Here in Ontario, students will take math all the way through to grade 12. In science, they can stop at grade 10. Mm. You have obviously a close relationship with the way the science works. Would you make the same argument for science and maybe pushing it further up?
Yes, I can't imagine stopping at 10, particularly since I don't think calculus makes sense without physics to a lot of students. I think there's a certain kind of mind, these algebraic thinkers, you know, the abstract thinkers, that, you know, that there's a small subset of the population that for whom algebra and calculus and math makes perfect sense. They have this wonderful intuitive grasp of it. I am not that person. And I talked to a lot of people who said, you know, I actually was totally confused by calculus, and then I took physics, and suddenly it all started, I had a context, and suddenly it started clicking into place. And then because I had used it to solve some problems, I began to really appreciate the abstraction a bit more. So Yeah, I'm also not a big fan, again, of this either-or, this idea that you don't have to take something. You should want to take something because it's enriching. You know, we don't have to take art. We don't have to learn, you know, music. I played the piano for a very long time, and I would spend hours on scales and wonder why I was doing them. And then I realized it was so that I might one day play Chopin, because those scales ended up getting incorporated into these wonderful, beautiful pieces that are timeless. Same thing for math, same thing for science.
Hi, I just I wanted to ask you your opinion on the or your view on the relationship between language and mathematics, because the older I've gotten, and my buddy and myself, we haven't had a background in physics ourselves, but one of the things I've noticed over time is that the relationship between language and mathematics, to my mind, is just another type of language. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we sold mathematics as an alternate way or a more efficient way of communicating, there might be greater uptake. But I wonder what your views are as a science and math writer.
Well, I certainly approached it as a language. I mean, Galileo had this famous quotation that, you know, the language of nature, you know, is mathematics. It's written in mathematics. That is certainly how physicists understand nature, how they look at the world around them. It's not an accident that I mentioned the guy that invented algebra, that originally algebra was in fact words. That was a huge thing for me when I realized that they were words. And because I get words. You know, I do have an intuitive sense of syntax and sentence structure and things like that, of grammar. And once I started thinking of it that way, then it became just these rules. Maybe they didn't come as easily to me. Maybe it wasn't quite as intuitive as language was, but I also use language more. And I found that the more I did my calculus problems, the easier a derivative or integral became. I started becoming more comfortable with that language. It's the use it or lose it model. You know, you kind of got to do the immersion thing, and you've got to do it at a fairly young age if you really want to be fluent. I would say that I'm really not fluent in calculus, but I can get by. I can order off the menu. You know, and, you know, I can find my way around Paris.
Yeah, hi. Not to stir the pot too much, but I was wondering if you could address the sort of the culture of the politics behind what you said earlier about students saying, I'm never going to use it, so why should I learn it? Mm-hmm. This very utilitarian attitude is a problem not just for math and physics, but in fact for a whole host of disciplines mm-hmm. on both sides of the arts and science divide. And I'm wondering if you could address what does seem to be an increasing emphasis on this kind of dry utilitarianism where, you know, if I can't use it for anything, if I can't get a job, what's the point of studying it?
Well, I don't think this is new. I do think it's unfortunate. If you look at, you know, the American educational system is actually very good at teaching very fundamental basics of, you know, literacy. You can argue that point, you know, because we want them to be even more literate, but in fact, if you look back to, like, the 1700s in America, very few people could read and write, and now most people can. Not everyone. We still have a problem with illiteracy, but they might not do it well, you know, but they nonetheless do have some basics. But it is a utilitarian kind of a factory model, and I think that, and I agree with you, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I, you know, brought up the notion of, you know, why we study art, why we study music, why we have these things. If your only question is, when am I ever going to use this, you are asking the wrong question. And that definitely is what I was trying to get across. That's why I phrased it in terms of making it about choice, because I think that's something people can understand. You can appeal to their altruism all you want, but the fact is most people are pretty pragmatic, and many people do not have the luxury of studying things for purely for their aesthetic value. I consider myself extremely fortunate that I have a career that allows me to think about and write about these things and talk to scientists and spend my time on this rather than having to worry about where the next, you know, meal is coming from. You know, the average person, single mom who's like waiting tables on double shift, or a college student who's like trying to work to pay off student loans, this is a reality. And oftentimes, the aesthetics and the altruism gets lost, and I think we need a little bit of compassion on that. On the flip side, when we're talking about the infrastructure, yes, it is far too utilitarian. We definitely are very test score oriented. We want to measure everything, and we have metrics, and our metrics are our test scores, and that may or may not be a good indication of whether students are learning. I got great scores, That didn't mean I was good at it. That meant I understood what I was doing. It meant that I was really good at gaming the system. So I think we really kind of need to be careful of that as well. So, I mean, I'm kind of rambling here a bit because it's a complicated question. I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I agree that we should study these things for themselves, and that there is value in that, and that it is definitely wrong, particularly when it comes to higher education, to solely focus on utilitarianism. But I think we also have to recognize that most people don't have that luxury.
Thank you. That's a wonderful way to finish. Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank Jennifer Lowe.
Thank you.